This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Here we go into a new year with a new climate. In this program, we will look back and forward with the remarkable Dr. Paul Salomon from Rainforest Trust. Content warning, a little optimism may creep in. Then one of the strangest outcomes on a warming planet, babies who experience even a short period of heat stress in the womb will, on average, have a lower income 30 years later. Think about what that means as we explore new science led by Dr. Maya Rawson-Slater from the Stanford School of Medicine. Earlier in December, Alaska and Yukon were hotter than parts of the lower 48 states and where I live. A friend returned from the far north where they wondered if they would have a white Christmas at all in the Yukon. California experienced its largest ever wildfire, not in the usual summer fire season, but in December. Now we have a cold Arctic blast over most of North America. Right on cue, President Trump makes his first presidential tweet on climate change, saying, quote, "We could use a little bit of that good old global warming." To celebrate the end of his first year, where he passed more legislation than any president in the history of the universe, Trump has removed the safeguards on fracking put into place by the Obama administration. Go ahead. Pump toxic chemicals near the schoolyard and in national parks. We will never ask you what's in those fracking chemicals, because we can't. Meanwhile, the Philippines is trying to clean up after yet another deadly tropical typhoon, as the hits keep on coming. I'll cover all that, but we won't stop there. It was never my role to be a disaster reporter. Instead, this year, we will continue to dig into the causes and the processes behind the news. And I'll be looking for any source of real optimism and voices helping us cope with an unstable world. I'm Alex Smith. Welcome back to Radio EcoShock. ...2017 was a dizzying mix of dangerous politics and environmental records, and not the records we want. What really happened? Is there anything each of us can do to help? We will find out. I know it's common to look back at a year, but it is uncommon to have the eyes of one of the world's leading conservationists. Paul Salomon was inspired as a child, and he managed a small nature reserve in London by the age of 14. His work in South America helped create new nature preserves in Colombia and other countries. Growing up as a birder in the UK, Paul helped found Fundación Pro Aves, the South American charity for protection of the birds. Four new bird species were brought to science by him, and after a distinguished career in science and conservation, Dr. Paul Salomon is now Chief Executive Officer for Rainforest Trust. Paul, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Great to be with you, Alex.
I appreciate you helping us out. So before we get to some personal New Year's resolutions, let's work through the top five impact stories from your report. At number one, we have the retrenchment of a leading world economic and military power. Is the American withdrawal from the Paris Accord a blip or a blow to climate progress?
Well, I think it's somewhere probably in the middle, to be honest, Alex. I think the U.S. continues to be the leader in the environment and leads on innovation and technology that's going to help lead to the renewable energy solutions for the future. However, of course, it's disappointing that the federal government is no longer taking that leadership role. I mean, it's just, for the first ever agreement of any area to have all 194 countries sign up to it is remarkable. I mean, it's the first time in the history of mankind. And now, unfortunately, the U.S. has pulled out of it. It's just a really tragic, disappointing decision. But we do hope it will reverse in the future. And I know that, if anything, it's made efforts at the sort of state levels and city levels actually much more important. And I think on the ground, we're going to see more action happen. So actually, if anything, it may actually be a good thing in the future. But, of course, it's disappointing that the federal government's not leading on this.
Paul Salmon, please talk to us about the emergence of extreme weather events.
Yes. So, I mean, as we've known, we're preaching to the converted here listening to your radio station. We've all seen the statistics. There's no doubt what's going on. I think that we should highlight, looking back at 2017, the fact that 13 U.S. agencies came together to publish the Climate Science Special Report, together unanimously noting that impacts so far in the last century has been 1.8-degree increase, and the outlook is a further 2.5 degrees in the coming decades, and that is man-made. That's clear in the report. So this isn't in doubt. This isn't something that's we still need to look through the data further. I think the main thing is we've just had this terrible year of really severe environmental impacts from extreme weather. You know, in 2015 and 2016, we can say, okay, it was the El Nino phenomena. We can say that there was always going to be some variation and some extreme impacts. But this year, this 2017, was supposedly a normal year for weather in terms of there was nothing particularly complicated going on, and we've seen actually some of the most severe impacts. Three hurricanes of Category 4 or more hitting the U.S., and of course many other hurricanes. We've seen droughts. We've got the largest forest fire in California state history ongoing. I mean, it's just tragic, and the sad thing is that millions of lives have been impacted in the U.S. and abroad. And also, we've seen, tragically, thousands of lives lost across the planet from these extreme weather events. So it really has been a particularly difficult year.
Yes, I can remember when I was following climate change in the 1990s, scientists talked about a very gradual warming. It was going to take a long time. But instead of a sloping graph, it seems like everything has been disturbed. Obama's White House science advisor, John Holdren, said, we should forget about global warming and use climate disruption. What do you think?
I don't know. Whatever you call it, the fact is that the data shows. I mean, we are progressively, the planet is getting warmer, and it is accelerating beyond some of our, you know, conservative estimates and even close to the most extreme. I think, as I say, this year, given that it was supposedly a year without some of the disruption, it's just startling to see, you know, we've had the highest temperatures ever recorded in the U.S. in Nevada. You know, we've had major heat waves. It's going to be one of the top years for temperature, and we're continuing in that direction. I think that the main thing is, we need to focus on what are the solutions. We need to look at what are the major factors here and what we can address quickly. And from our standpoint, from Rainforest Trust, we wish that more people would identify and see that actually rainforest destruction is a significant factor in carbon emissions. And actually it is absolutely, without doubt, the easiest one to address right now and for very cost-effective solutions.
For a couple of years there was some news that the Amazon deforestation had been slowed and somehow. Has the retreat of tropical rainforests been contained?
Absolutely not. If anything, it's accelerated, I'm afraid, Alex. We've seen at the moment, for many, many years, it's averaged approximately 25 million acres of tropical forest being clear-cut every year. And that's not even factoring in degradation and other impacts, which are going on as we speak. This area is the size of the state of Virginia, and often referred to as the size of Wales in the UK. These areas are incredibly important. You know, it's our most precious habitat in terms of flora and fauna. To the broader public, it's known as the lungs of the planet. And so having this loss continue to go on, it's not abating. And sadly, it's in some areas it's accelerating. For example, we see now in Colombia, a country that's just gone through a 50-year insurgency war, it's coming into prosperity and peace at last, and deforestation is jumping to 40% a year-on-year increase. And this is tragic. It really is something that we should have got our arms around by now.
Paul, you have been a champion of the birds. What is the status of birds as they experience both loss of habitat and climate disruption?
Yes, I mean, I had a scientific paper published on that impact on climate change for birds in the Andes of South America. And it's clear that there are very serious consequences for many species, particularly on those that are on the higher parts of mountains that have very few options in terms of moving up in elevation. And also because degradation and deforestation is basically limiting options in terms of movement. So really there's a major impact on birds in the coming decades. But really some of the biggest impacts are actually going to be felt on amphibians that are very sensitive to whether it be stream temperatures. You know, a small opening in the forest can change the temperature of a river and or a stream and actually directly impact amphibians. And we're seeing, obviously, chytrid fungi on amphibians across the particularly South America, Central America, that's impacting. And increasingly, as we get more information on plants and other groups, and that's something that Rainforest Trust focuses on. We don't just look at the mega charismatic megafauna. We're looking actually some of our biggest interests are the critters that are overlooked. It's amphibians, plants, and invertebrates. So these are the things that we really need to keep an eye out for especially.
Absolutely. I'm so glad that you are doing that. I was tempted to skip over your fourth top story of 2017, which you called Overturned Wildlife Protections. Do laws to protect wildlife really work?
Absolutely. The Endangered Species Act is absolutely spectacular. No country has anything similar to that, or at least is enforced as well as the U.S. It really is exceptional. I think that the fact that some of those legislations are being watered down or even overturned is of concern in the present administration. But as I say, at the end of the day, the U.S. is a champion on the environment at the state level, local level, and a lot of good stuff is still going on. I think that our worries about, for example, we've seen in recent months a couple of the national monuments, in fact, not just a couple, 10 national monuments being impacted, seriously degraded. Bears Ears National Monument losing 83% of its area has been lost in the last month through the change in legislation. So there's lots of unfortunate things we're seeing. But I think overall, wildlife protection continues to be pretty robust in the U.S. Our bigger concerns is really international, particularly with the ivory trade. Pangolins continue to be the most trafficked species, things like that.
Our final story in 2017 and what the Rainforest Trust promises is a new annual environmental year in review. It's really the big one, and this is what I think could kill off the rich bounty of our world. It's unsustainable fossil fuel dependency. A decade ago, fossil fuels were declared unsustainable because they would run out, peak oil, but that has not happened yet. Paul, has the climate threat overtaken peak oil as the driver of why we have to get off fossil fuels?
I think so, actually. You know, it's very interesting. I was asked a question a couple of days ago whether just because we're in prosperous times, people are worried about the environment. And, you know, we saw a real revolution with corporates and companies across the planet in the dark days of 2008, 2009 depression and governments going under and things like that. The environment actually stayed on top, and it's good for business. It's actually, you know, at the end of the day, you know, being more efficient and using less resources, maybe not heating your offices to such high temperatures or using so much paper, things like that, actually is good for business. And we've really seen that companies continue that drive towards sustainability. And of course, fossil fuel dependency, we've seen amazing challenges or statements come out of major car companies this year on, you know, by 2040, or they're going to be all electric cars. And I mean, these are the sort of bold moves by companies and, of course, by individuals that are really going to keep us moving in this direction. It certainly gives me hope.
Radio EcoShock.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. My guest is a prized scientist and conservationist, Dr. Paul Salomon, from the Rainforest Trust. With so many stories, Paul, of environmental disasters in 2017 and some big governments at least in failure mode. There are people out there who think we're just going to have to give up. What do you think?
Well, we've only got one planet. You know, the last time we sent someone to the moon, which is only, you know, just orbiting around us, was when I was just a few years old, back in the early 70s. And so I say, well, you're giving up on the planet. You're giving up on future generations. You're giving up on your own, you know, children's future or your friend's future. It's just not acceptable. We have to do better. And we are doing better, but we can do more. And so don't give up hope. Let's work together. I think that there's a lot of really positive things happening these days.
You started saving natural habitats when very young. Realistically, beyond sending a check to our environmental charities, which we should do, what can we as simple citizens do to help nature cope?
Well, the truth is there's lots of things. You can see our environmental year in review on our website at rainforesttrust.org, and we have actually some suggested resolutions on ways that us as the listeners can sort of take some ideas and implement them. I mean, there's a lot of simple things. I mean, this year there was a campaign over plastic straws. We realize 500 million plastic straws are used in restaurants every day in the U.S. I mean, that's incredible waste. I mean, we can just sip from a glass, right? There's certainly really major advances in awareness, and I think that the main thing is to continue to have hope. Look at obviously there's recycling and lots of things that we're well aware of now, but there's lots of innovative ideas out there that can make your life much more sustainable and harmonious with the planet.
My friends at the Canadian-based charity Canopy are working away with major clothing brands and Chinese viscose producers to make it clear where that fiber comes from, to tell us what forests have been cut down for fashion clothes. How can we extend the know your source mantra that's in your report much further?
In Europe, there's much better labeling of products to know what's in there. One of the biggest drivers of deforestation at the moment, particularly in Southeast Asia, is oil palm. And it's really disappointing to see the variety of labeling on products that use it, that try to hide it as like vegetable oil or things like this. And so better labeling is really essential. It's not just about, selecting your product. It's about just knowing what's going into your body. It's really important from a health perspective to know that we're eating the right things. And I think that becomes increasingly important. So good labeling is really essential.
And I read those labels because there's some incredible chemicals in some of our food that should not be there. Now, I'm experimenting with geothermal heat for a greenhouse in cold Canada. But at every step, Paul, it seems I need to buy more stuff. And I worry that even conversion to clean energy sources may kick this planetary climate even further off base. Can you talk to us about how we can manage consumption?
Yeah, no, that's very true. It's like, for example, you want to get a hybrid car, you want to give up your gasoline car for a hybrid or an electric. Well, the truth is that a lot of energy and resources went in to produce that new car. And actually, it turns out sometimes it may be better to run that small, compact, gasoline car, petrol car than it is to actually switch over to electric. But though ultimately we need to do this. So it is a real challenge knowing what is the right approach. I think that ultimately governments and companies are starting to move strongly in that direction. It just makes sense from a business perspective, and we should encourage it. When we have the option to get solar or wind energy, we should embrace it. And I think they're the sort of actions that each one of us can take. I know that not everywhere has the choice. Not everyone has the opportunity to put in a geothermal system, which is extremely expensive. But as technology develops, it will become more cheaper and hopefully much easier to put in.
Another solution in your annual review is a simple resolution for 2018, go outdoors. Why does that matter, Paul?
We need to connect with nature. I think that's one of the, when you appreciate the world around you, When you appreciate that habitats and wild areas give life on Earth, I think you'll have an understanding of why it's important to protect it and maintain it. And so that's why we say at a time when there's so many distractions to stay indoors or stay in the mall or wherever, I think it's time, you know, we also need to make time to get out and enjoy nature. I'm very fortunate. Our office is in the Piedmont of Northern Virginia. It's a beautiful landscape, very close to Shenandoah National Park. We love it. It's a great place to be, and it inspires us. And I know that when people go out, enjoy nature, it's inspirational, it's refreshing, it's a stress reliever, and we need to do it more.
And I have to admit, in 2017, I did fail your last resolution to stay positive, and that's still one of my hopes for 2018. So what can we do to maintain our sanity during what looks like an ecological collapse, or is that question itself too negative?
That's too negative. Look, it is a pivotal moment. There's no doubt about it that the coming years will really be extremely influential in how we shape our future planet. Some say it's too late. I disagree. I think that actually, as we learn more, there is a tremendous amount of resilience on our planet, the species, across nature, and within humans. And so we just have to continue on. We need to stay positive. And I know that there's things going on, a crisis in the leadership in the U.S. and on the environmental front. These things, I think at the end of the day, it's in the individual. It comes down to communities and cities that make the decisions. You know, even in areas that are very challenged, maybe in, you know, like coal-producing areas, they're turning to renewable energy. They've got wind farms. They are embracing technology. There is hope. So I say, please stay positive.
Do you think the call or just the sight of a single bird or a flock of birds can help lift us up?
Absolutely. It does for me. I know that there's lots of other people when they see a bird, they marvel. Unfortunately, there's too many that just pass over it. You have selective vision, and I think that we need to open our eyes. And when we see a flock of geese flying overhead, or a chickadee, or a robin, it's just wonderful to just take pause for a second and enjoy those moments.
Yes, take the time. There is a message there. Why did the Rainforest Trust decide to create an annual environmental year in review?
Alex, that's a very good question. Well, firstly, there is none. No one's ever produced an environmental year in review. We were kind of surprised when we were looking up who was summarizing this kind of information. And we thought, well, why not do it? It's been a year of really tremendous environmental impact. And as Rainforest Trust, a collection of esteemed scientists and environmental conservationists, we thought it was great to come together, put together this information, and really give it to the public. Well, we focus on work across the tropics. The truth is that the issues are much bigger. It affects the whole planet, and what goes on in the U.S., in Europe, Canada, really does influence significantly the whole planet. And one of the things that we really wanted to highlight, Alex, was the fact that massive loss of tropical forests are being overlooked, as we discussed, but really that they are incredibly important for their carbon dioxide emissions when deforested, and that just stopping deforestation will actually significantly reduce carbon dioxide emissions by a fifth. And also the chance to regenerate these areas will actually capture up to half of all of the emissions. And so we can really, part of the solution that we're facing is actually a large chunk of it is in the tropics. And when we're saving acres for as little as $2 to permanently save an acre of rainforest, that's not so expensive. In fact, you think of what an electric car costs, you can save hundreds, thousands of acres. It really is important.
So what does the Rainforest Trust do?
Well, the Rainforest Trust, we're just entering our 30th anniversary. For the last 30 years, we've stuck to our clear mission of purchasing and protecting tropical forests for endangered species. And we do that with local organizations, indigenous communities, local communities that we provide technical support, know-how, strategically identify the most important areas for these endangered species, and we work to protect them, provide them the resources. And we continue over the years to support those areas to make sure that they're sustainable and that they're going to be there for the future. That's our work.
Well, as we wrap up, I want to ask you a hard question. Can you really see a future where things get better instead of worse?
Yes. Unfortunately, to be realistic, it will get a bit worse before it gets better. That's the truth. However, I am confident that it will get better, and it's not so far away. I think we are turning a corner. I know we've had some bumps in the road, but we are turning a corner, and I can see that awareness is really growing. I can tell you this firsthand, because when you go out to poor rural communities across the tropics, when you get to some of the most isolated peoples, they know the climate is changing. They know more than most people in well-educated countries, and they feel it, and they know they have to change. And to see that gives me hope, because often they don't need to be convinced. They're actually asking just for the support on how to do it. And so that really gives hope, and I'm sure in the future things will get better.
We have been talking with the world-known scientist and conservationist Dr. Paul Salomon. Dr. Salomon is the Chief Executive Officer of the Rainforest Trust. You can find more links to his work in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Paul, thank you so much for sharing with us on Radio EcoShock.
It was wonderful to be on Radio EcoShock with you, Alex. Thank you so much.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Here is an incredible twist to living in a hotter world. If you experienced heat stress in the womb or as a baby, your earnings could be lower 30 years later. Not possible, you say? Listen to this. Dr. Maya Rosten-Slater is a fellow at the Stanford Institute for Economic Policy Research and assistant professor of health and research and policy at Stanford University School of Medicine. She is co-author of a new paper, Relationship Between Season of Birth, Temperature Exposure, and Later Life Well-Being. That was just published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Maya Rosten-Slater, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, this study comes at global warming from a very odd angle. Who was it that wondered about the long-term impacts of heat? What is the history and the motivation of this paper?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think there's two strands of literature, two strands of evidence that motivate this paper. So first is that there's this growing interest in trying to understand how factors in the very early life, including, you know, in the fetal stage, the uterus stage, affect outcomes throughout the life cycle for people. And there's a growing body of evidence across disciplines. I'm an economist by training, so there's been a lot of attention to this in the economics literature, but also in epidemiology, in the medical literature, sociology, and so on, trying to understand how a variety of different environmental, health, nutrition, economic factors affecting people in the in utero period, as well as at the very early life, so the first few years of life, could have these really lasting long-term consequences on later economic, health, educational outcomes. And so, you know, we were motivated to look at temperature in particular, extreme heat, in part because there's already evidence that, you know, other types of environmental factors have these long-term consequences. So, for instance, I've done some work looking at the effects of air pollution exposure in the early life period and finding that it has long-term adverse consequences for people's later outcomes. You know, people have looked at other factors like natural disasters, lead, water pollution, and so on.
Radiation, too.
Yeah, and radiation is a very big one as well. Now, maybe temperature seems kind of a milder environmental factor, perhaps. But, you know, there's already evidence from other studies, not ours, showing that exposure to extreme heat during pregnancy can lead to lower birth weight and even increased infant mortality. So there's some evidence out there that suggests that exposure to extreme heat could have adverse consequences on early life health. So then that begs the question of, well, are there long-term consequences as well, especially given what we know about the fetal period as well as the, you know, the first couple years of life being so important for impacting longer outcomes. And then I think the second motivation for the study was, you know, thinking broadly about issues related to climate change and thinking broadly about issues related to the projection that we're supposed to be experiencing more and more days with extreme temperature, in particular extreme heat, you know, by the end of the century. And most of the research about topics related to climate change, you know, tries to think about the costs and benefits associated with these projected increases, sort of in the relatively immediate term, right? So trying to understand, for instance, again, I'm an economist, so there's studies looking at how exposure to extreme temperatures affects productivity among the workforce. And so, you know, and so then that obviously has implications for GDP and per capita income and so on. We're trying to take a kind of a more nuanced but perhaps longer-term approach in trying to understand, well, yes, we know that there could be effects kind of contemporaneously, so immediately, on these economic outcomes. But is it possible that there could also be longer-term consequences operating through this most intergenerational channel? And so that's kind of another motivation for the study, is trying to think, well, if we want to really have a good understanding of what are the costs and benefits associated with climate change, as well as policies trying to address climate change, you know, this is another factor that we should be putting into those calculations.
Okay, now in this research, how did you show there is a link between early heat and later earnings?
Yeah, so in order to be able to try to do something like that, you actually need quite a lot of data. And so we were fortunate in that we've been working with this database called the Longitudinal Employer Household Dynamic Database. So what it is it essentially contains information on people's earnings. So quarterly level earnings data, and it's linked to information on individuals' counties and exact dates of birth. Okay, so what that enables us to do is it allows us to link to very detailed weather data that's at the daily level. So we're able to measure for any given person that's born on any given date in a particular county, what's their exposure to different temperatures during, you know, 9 months before their date of birth and, say, during the first year of life. You know, so we can calculate how many days during the 9 months before your date of birth did you have a temperature that was on average higher than, say, 90 degrees Fahrenheit. Okay? So we first create this linkage. And then, of course, we don't want to just be comparing people that are exposed to more hot days to other people who are exposed to fewer hot days, because, you know, there's a lot of differences between people, say, living in very hot climates in the U.S. and people living in cooler climates in the U.S., right? There's a lot of geographic differences. There's a lot of things that are unrelated completely to temperature. So in order to be able to sort of separate causation from correlation, in order to be able to hone in on this specific effect of exposure to extreme heat, what we do is the following. We compare only people born within the same county. Okay, so we're never comparing across geographic areas. We're looking at people born within the same county. And in fact, people born on the exact same day of the year, right? So as a thought experiment, you can imagine taking some county. Let's say, this is again just an example, let's say we take Harris County, Texas, And we're going to compare two people, person A and person B. They're both born on the exact same day of the year. So let's say they're both born on February 5th. But they're born in different years. So one is born in 1970 and one is born in 1971. And it just so happens that there is a large heat wave in this county during 1971 and not during 1970. Okay? And so what that's going to mean is that these two people that are born in the same county on the exact same day of the year, but just the different years that happen to have where one has a heat wave and one doesn't, are going to be exposed to different numbers of high temperature days. Okay? We're also, in addition to just looking at people born in the same county and on the exact same day of the year, we're also looking only at people, comparing people within race and within gender. Okay, so we're not looking sort of across race or across gender. We're looking at people of the same race and of the same gender, at least as recorded in our data, or in the exact same county and on the exact same day of the year, and comparing their exposure to different temperatures. And we're also, on top of that, because we're using nearly 10 years of data or nearly 10 cohorts of individuals, so we want to account for the fact that people born in 1970 just experienced different trends and economic outcomes and so on from people, say, born in 1977 overall. So we're also controlling for overall trends over this time period. So that's kind of the best that we can do with our data to try to say something, you know, very specific and precise and causal about the effect of exposure to heat. But of course, you know, we didn't run a randomized experiment where, you know, we randomly assigned some people to have a lot of hot days and other people to not have hot days. So we can never be 100% sure that this is, you know, purely causal, but we think that we're doing a pretty good job. One last thing that I'll say about this, unless you want me to say more, is that, you know, one of our findings that we think is important and interesting is that exposure to air conditioning is mitigating nearly all of the effects of exposure to extreme heat. So if you thought this was something else was going on, right, so if you thought that this wasn't about heat and this was just we're picking up some differences that are just related to heat that are about something else, then there would be no reason to think that air conditioning would play a role in it. So I think the fact that we're finding that air conditioning, which can, you know, is something that can be used to combat exposure to extreme heat, is actually mitigating our effect, is reassuring us that we are estimating something about exposure to heat.
Well, just one quick question from that. How could you possibly know how many people had air conditioning in the 1970s?
Excellent question. So actually the U.S. Census, the Decennial Census, has information at the county level on what fraction of households had air conditioning. So they record this information in the census years. So I should be more careful in explaining the research design. So in our data, right, we know we have individual level data where we observe people's earnings around age 30, and then we know their date of birth and their county of birth. We don't know in our data whether that person, any given individual, had air conditioning in their home when they were born. But we know that, again, going back to that example of Harris County, Texas, we know approximately what fraction of households in Harris County, Texas, had air conditioning in 1970 as well as in 1980, okay? And so that allows us to compare, basically, people who were born in counties that had high share air conditioning adoption versus people born in counties that had lower shares of air conditioning adoption and see whether the effect of temperature differs across those places.
Well, unfortunately, Maya, this study vindicates air conditioning. It appears that any woman expecting pregnancy should have AC during high heat. But if everyone everywhere gets air conditioning, then we get the power demands from fossil fuel, and that makes the outdoors hotter and hotter, makes climate change worse. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I completely agree with what you said. I don't think that the takeaway of our study is, you know, all pregnant women should go run into air conditioning, although perhaps you could read it that way. I think the takeaways are a little bit more nuanced and sort of you have to think about it kind of the full picture as you suggest. So with air conditioning, as you say, it's not free in any way, right? It's not free from an individual level. You have to pay to install air conditioning in your household. And of course, it has all kinds of environmental costs as well. So to the extent that we're trying to do cost-benefit analyses to think about policies that try to address climate change, you know, the lot of different proposals, we have to take into account not just the direct effects of exposure to extreme heat, right? So we're offering some evidence on what's the direct effect of exposure to extreme heat in utero on long-term earnings outcomes, but also to try to understand what are the costs of any potential adaptation responses. Okay, so this is anything that people do to try to avoid exposure to any harmful effects of extreme temperatures. In our particular context, we're looking at air conditioning, which you can think about being as a costly technology that people can adopt in order to mitigate these effects. But we have to, any cost-benefit calculation has to take into account what are the costs associated with people using these technologies. And so I think that's sort of the bigger takeaway from the study. I think a related issue with regard to air conditioning is the fact that, you know, this study is based in the United States. When people look at this, they say, okay, but pretty much everybody has air conditioning these days, although, of course, not everybody. But, you know, a good share of households in the United States, especially in hotter climates, have air conditioning. So is this really that big of a deal? As you point out, you know, there's some environmental costs associated with air conditioning. But also, if we take a more global perspective, you know, countries that have some of the hottest climates in the world actually don't have that much air conditioning. So if we're thinking about global inequality, global consequences of climate change, you know, this is one mechanism by which inequality could actually grow if we think about the differences between developing and more developed countries. You know, hotter there's a lot of research that's trying to link climate to development, and we're sort of honing in on one mechanism, which is this intergenerational component of having exposure in either the in utero or early childhood stage on long-term earnings, which is also correlated with productivity and labor force participation. So if we're thinking about ways to address global inequality, ways to address differing impacts of climate change across different nations in the world, understanding how these effects interact with technologies that exist, such as air conditioning, and that exist differentially across different countries, is important.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I am Alex Smith. My guest is Maya Rawson-Slater. We're talking about the impact of heat stress in the womb and on toddlers showing up in lower earnings decades later. She is a research fellow with several organizations. I guess, Maya, I could call you a kind of public health economist. Would that be accurate?
Yes, that's actually a pretty good title. I'm interested in both health economics and public economics and the intersection of those two.
Given this new study results, is it possible we could raise the standard of living simply by providing optimum conditions for pregnancy and the first year of life?
That's a big question. You know, I've done some other work on, you know, not just temperature, but a variety of other public interventions targeting the very early childhood period. I'm not by any means the only one that has done this work. There's now a growing body of evidence, in many ways pioneered by people like James Heckman, Nobel laureate economist in Chicago, focusing on the importance of investing in the early childhood period. So I'm definitely, you know, my own work and the work of many others does suggest that intervening with public policies that try to, as you say, create optimal conditions, whether it's during pregnancy or in the first, let's say, 5 years of life, could have really huge returns in terms of improving outcomes of the next generation. So I'm very much sympathetic to policies that do target this period, but I also want to caution against, you know, sort of using a one-size-fits-all approach and saying, okay, we're only going to focus on this period if we're only going to invest in this period and we're sort of going to ignore other periods of life. I think there's still a lot of evidence showing that, you know, the other thing I'll say is that one common misunderstanding of this line of work is that it's to suggest that this means that if you sort of don't intervene in that period, you kind of missed out, and then it's like a lost cause. And I think that's a pretty terrible and depressing misunderstanding because, you know, kids are quite resilient. There's a lot of evidence saying that. So even if you don't have optimal pregnancy conditions, or if you have stress, or if you have very high temperatures, or if you have exposure to other kinds of negative shocks, you know, it turns out that intervening in later life, it turns out that, you know, supporting people as they go through schooling, supporting their health, their access to health insurance throughout their childhood and adulthood is also very important. So I will say that I, in general, believe and think the evidence supports investing resources into policies that target the early childhood period as well as pregnant women, but I also think that not all is lost. So for any listeners that, you know, think about their own life or think about their own pregnancy, let's say, and think, oh wow, I didn't have the most optimal conditions, am I doomed? I hope that the takeaway message is that no, you're not, and that there's a lot of other interventions that can occur and a lot of resilience that we observe.
Your study's based on averages and statistics, aren't they? I mean, that doesn't mean to say that one of those hot kids from Harris County might not turn out to be Bill Gates or Carl Sagan.
Exactly. And also, you should remember that our effects are quite small when we look at the individual level, right? So what we're finding is having one more day of very hot temperatures, so above 32 degrees Celsius or, you know, about 90 degrees Fahrenheit on average. This is mean temperature. This is not the max mean temperature day. Having one more of those during pregnancy reduces annual earnings at age 30 by about $30, right? So $30 on an annual basis is not a very huge amount. So even if you calculate sort of the lifetime earnings loss associated with that, it's still not a very large amount. So our point is not to say that at the individual level, you know, having exposure to extreme heat is really, really bad. You know, in terms of things to worry about during pregnancy in the early childhood stage, extreme heat should not be at the forefront of people's worries. But our point is to say, okay, maybe at an individual level, this effect is not that big. But if we're trying to, again, going back to trying to understand consequences of climate change, well, we have to scale that number up by the number of people who are exposed to these extreme temperatures, how that's going to change by the end of the century. And then, you know, pretty quickly you get actually much bigger numbers.
Maya, does this give a slight advantage to people in cooler states like the Northeast versus those in the U.S. Southwest or the traditional South? Please talk to us about the regional differences emerging out of your study.
Yeah, so I think we have to be careful in terms of drawing conclusions about regional differences. As I said, first of all, our research design is explicitly not comparing across regions, right? We're comparing only within geographic areas, small geographic areas, meaning counties. And one sort of conceptual reason that we actually do that, in addition to trying to better understand the causality, but it's also there's some evidence that suggests that, you know, people can adapt to hot climates. So part of what we're actually identifying is exposure to very unusually hot days, right? So the example that I was sort of bringing up before, well, you know, we're looking at people born in the same county, but one happened to have been in utero during an extreme heat wave and one not, right? So it's not so much that on average in the Northeast, temperatures are cooler than in the South, right? But it's about, you know, what's the chance that you are used to, or your, you know, people in your locality are used to relatively cool temperatures all the time, and then suddenly you're hit with an extreme heat wave versus you're used to pretty hot temperatures all the time, but you don't really have that many heat waves, right? So it's sort of different questions a little bit. So I don't think our results can really speak to understanding regional differences in outcomes. I think there's a lot of other factors that account for regional differences that are not related to temperature.
But you mentioned other countries, and I guess this is a human trait, not just a cultural trait. Would I be right in thinking that?
Sure. Yeah. So I mentioned other countries in part to sort of give a framework for thinking about, you know, why it matters whether or not we have access to air conditioning, right? In part to sort of motivate that there's many other countries that actually have a lot of heat waves or a lot of hot days but don't have air conditioning. And there is actually, you know, there is some research that's trying to understand differences across countries in productivity and GDP growth and so on, and trying to relate them to climate. It's, you know, as you can imagine, and as I sort of hinted at in talking about the regional differences, it's really hard to draw those links in a super precise way because, you know, there are just so many differences across countries, right? That it's really hard to isolate, you know, what is happening due to climate or temperature in particular versus all kinds of institutional differences, cultural differences, and so on. And so that's why I'm a little bit hesitant to draw very concrete conclusions about differences across regions. But you know, you could imagine that maybe temperature does play a role in explaining a little bit of the variation across regions in, say, average earnings or average labor market outcomes. We just don't have any very good evidence on that. Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. This kind of ties into an interview I did a few weeks ago with Camilo Mora from the University of Hawaii, and he was talking about research into heat deaths and why people die from heat. And he talked about organ damage that could take years or decades to show up later. And that sounds a little bit like what we're talking about now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Definitely. I think there's this growing interest, and I mean, now for several decades, actually, but into trying to understand kind of latent effects of shocks, of health shocks. And so, you know, in talking about what are the very long-term consequences of exposure to extreme heat in the early life stage, we relate to something called the fetal origins hypothesis, which is this idea that was first put forth by David Barker, a physician, in the early 1990s, that suggests that conditions in the very early life period, in utero stage, could have long-term consequences 50, 60, 70 years later that don't actually appear till then. And he was talking about health shocks. He was talking about disease prevalence. You know, you could think about it more broadly in that if there are these latent consequences from health shocks at one point in life that don't appear until much, much later, it can have effects on all kinds of outcomes that are not just health, but also economic productivity, labor market attachment, and so on.
Wow. It seems like this study is part of a whole new range in public health research as the planet warms into more extreme heat waves. Maya, where do you think this can go, and what will you be working on next?
So I think it's definitely, there's a lot of, as the planet changes and as research evolves, there's a lot of exciting new research questions that can hopefully be studied with newly emerging data and inform public policy, both in the United States, which is where I'm based, as well as around the world. I'm continuing in the same research area, so I'm working on issues related to other types of public interventions in the early childhood period. So, for instance, nurse home visiting programs and access to public preschools. So that's one line of work that I do. In terms of on the environmental side, as I mentioned, I have one study on air pollution that looks at the early childhood exposure in utero as well as first year of life exposure to air pollution, and again, impacts on earnings around age 30. And then I look at other policies that target the same life stage, such as paid family leave in the United States, as well as in other countries as well.
I did an interview about 8 years ago about the impact of pollution on children in the womb, where pregnant mothers wore these backpacks around Harlem, which recorded everything that they were breathing. And we're able to show that there was actual changes, I believe, to the DNA from pollution. So that's another huge topic we could talk about maybe another time.
Yeah, no, that's very important and definitely relates to some of my research. That sounds great.
I'll send you a link to that. From the Stanford University School of Medicine, we've been speaking with Dr. Maya Rosten-Slater. She's co-authored a new paper published December 4th, 2017 in PNAS. The title is Relationship Between Season of Birth, Temperature Exposure, and Later Life Well-Being. Find links in my show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.org. Maya, thank you so much for sharing your time with all of us.
Thank you so much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. That's all the time we have for Radio EcoShock this week. I am back under protest, and I trust that protest will spread as humans realize we have destabilized the ecosphere. This isn't a debate or reality TV or entertainment. It is science and the daily reality we all experience. I've got some great guests coming up, including tools you can use. And don't forget, you can listen to or download all our past programs going back 11 years at my website at ecoshock.org. A full education on climate change, tropical forests, coral, and much more is just waiting for you, free of charge, from the leading scientists, authors, and activists from around the world at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Stay tuned.
Hi everyone, it's May with 350.org with a short end of the year message for you. 2017 was definitely a challenging year for the climate movement, for people impacted by climate change, and for our sister movements. But despite all of that, there were some things that happened that we can be proud of. In April, the People's Climate March brought hundreds of thousands of people to Washington, D.C., calling for climate justice, and it was a collaboration of hundreds of different organizations. Then there was the global divestment mobilization with over 260 events in 45 countries calling on institutions to divest from fossil fuels. And then quite recently at the UN Climate Talks, COP23, there were impressive efforts to call for a coal phase out in Germany, to hold the Trump administration to account, and to support the Pacific Climate Warriors Have Your Say declaration. We were also celebrating the cancellation of the Energy East tar sands pipeline, over 350 municipalities in Brazil having banned fracking. And just a few days ago, the pension funds of New York City and New York State, worth over $390 billion, have made a really impressive divestment commitment after years of fighting. So we are looking forward to 2018. And among the highlights that we are looking to, we're going to continue to battle the Keystone XL pipeline, always, through the Promise to Protect and Solar XL. We'll be working to halt new coal development in Africa through the Decolonize Africa campaign. And in September, there will be a global climate action summit hosted by Governor Jerry Brown, my home state of California, calling on subnational governments to make ambitious new climate commitments. You'll also be engaging with communities all across the country calling for fossil-free resolutions, and we hope you will be one of them.